So we're going to move on in a second and talk about metastatic disease, which of course is a big issue. And we're going to talk about not only checkpoint therapy, but also some of the new and novel strategies that are being used in metastatic disease. And sort of to kind of get us warmed up for that, let's hear about another case. 78-year-old lady, Anastasia, can you talk about her?
She is a lovely lady with past medical history of cervical cancer who received radiation for that disease. She's a non-smoker. In terms of other comorbidities, control hypertension, otherwise very fit lady. She initially presented with frequency, urgency, blood in the urine for a few months. Imaging was notable for bladder wall thickening, but there was no lymph nodes, no visceral disease. She proceeded with QRBT, which showed a high-grade muscle-invasive urothelial cancer. We did see her at that point and offer her neoadjuvant chemotherapy, and she declined.
Can you talk a little bit about her situation at that point after she was post-op, and were you enthusiastic about adjuvant therapy or just sort of presenting it as a possibility, and why did she decline it?
So after the cystectomy, her priorities were, she was not originally from New York, her priorities were to go back to her family and spend time with her family. So this was the most important thing for her. And unfortunately, she didn't come back to us until she became symptomatic. So when she came back to us, she had weight loss, insomnia, pain, and this is really what prompted her to come back to receive care. Her imaging, when we saw her in January, was unfortunately notable for widespread metastatic disease. And as I mentioned, she was pretty symptomatic. At that time, her creatinine clearance was pretty low, 37. So we could not offer her cisplatin-based therapy. We did PD-L1 staining on her cystectomy specimen, and it was low. Therefore, we offered her chemotherapy with carboplatin and gemcitabine, and she did very well on it. She had minimal symptoms. After the first cycle, she had almost resolution of her pain, fatigue, weight loss. And from the chemotherapy, the only thing that she complained about was mild fatigue. We premedicated her as per the recent ASCO guidelines with 3 lines of antiemetics. She didn't develop any nausea, and overall, she tolerated treatment and she had great response on imaging.
So I'm going to go back now and go through the whole issue of metastatic disease and get into where checkpoint inhibitors fit in. This lady had chemotherapy, very possibly, I guess likely that she actually will end up getting immunotherapy as second line therapy. But I want to just sort of walk through what we know in terms of sort of data, trials, and sort of what we know about bladder cancer and how it applies in this situation and others. And Peter, maybe we can start, this is a slide you had in your talk, about sort of where we were before checkpoint inhibitors in terms of chemotherapy, which is what this lady got.
Yes, I think Susan was alluding to this too. It does seem like a galaxy far, far away when platinum-based therapy was the only tool we had to treat bladder cancer. As you recall, you know, the first cisplatin-based therapies were developed in the mid-1980s with the introduction of MVAC. Gemcitabine cisplatin came onto the scene in the late 90s and was actually compared to MVAC and shown to be equivalent for patients with metastatic disease. And traditional MVAC was highly intolerable for patients, and so that is why, you know, the common practice among most community oncologists is to use gemcis or gemplatinum for a patient with metastatic urothelial cancer. Susan alluded to the fact that we often use dose-dense MVAC now, and most people who treat bladder cancer, that's the only form of MVAC that we will use, and so I still think it's a viable alternative to use dose-dense MVAC or gemcis as your frontline therapy. Now, of course, those two options are only used if the patient is eligible for cisplatin, as we've talked about. If they're not eligible for cisplatin, then we can substitute carboplatin, as we've talked about, knowing that it's likely inferior. The other option in the frontline setting is to go ahead and test your patient for PD-L1 status. If they are PD-L1 high, then there's 2 approved immunotherapies that can be given in the frontline setting, pembrolizumab or atezolizumab. And I would argue that if your patient's PD-L1 positive, these are really attractive options in that frontline setting for a cisplatin-ineligible patient. Much better tolerability than gem-carbo, and frankly, equivalent if not better outcomes, and that chance of a long-term durable response with frontline immunotherapy. The FDA does permit a sort of one loophole where if your patient is completely chemotherapy unfit, if you cannot imagine that your patient could even tolerate carboplatin-based therapy, then you can give frontline immunotherapy, either pembro or atezo, without PD-L1 testing. And then, of course, once your patient progresses through frontline platinum-based therapies, that's where the five immunotherapy drugs are approved.
So yeah, that's a great overview. Arjun, maybe you can talk a little bit about sort of the response rates. You know, this kind of drives the algorithm that Peter just went through. These are the data that sort of led to those algorithms. Can you walk through that?
Yeah, I think these plots are quite illustrative of just the comparison of chemotherapy and immunotherapy, but kind of at its initial efficacy. So, a response rate is one thing, and then the durability of responses and survival are two other things, right? But if you're looking at, disease control, I think these plots really help us understand how to make decisions, especially when we're facing a patient who's untreated. And many times, what we look at is, if you look at the far left, what you witness there is just the ability for cisplatinum to achieve a response to cancer. And this is particularly important for patients who have extensive disease burden and may be highly symptomatic from their cancer. And we know that achieving immediate disease control is critically important. And that's where the kind of the heavy hand of cisplatinum, or even to some degree carboplatinum, can be very effective. And then you contrast that on the right with the outcomes that you see with immunotherapy. I would argue that, the objective response rate with GemCarbo, which is really 36%. Okay, so let's be clear here. So the objective response rate with GemCarbo is actually 36. When you look at response rate overall, which includes unconfirmed and confirmed, that's when you see a 42% response rate. I think it's important to recognize that. But if you look at immunotherapy, the response rates are lower, right? So you're kind of taking a gamble there for patients if they really do want immunotherapy as an option. Response rates are lower. And that's where the biomarker is really helpful. So if you look at subgroups of patients who are PD-L1 high, and this is what Dr. O'Donnell was alluding to, especially with pembrolizumab, which was based off of KEYNOTE-52, was a well-powered study, 370 patients. It had enough patients on to really understand the nuances of the biomarker and how well it predicted for response. The PD-L1 high patients in that group had an objective response rate of 47%. And so that compares very favorably to platinum, where you don't have a biomarker, right? So we don't have a biomarker for who's going to respond to GemCarbo, but we do have one for immunotherapy. And so a PD-L1 high patient, objective response rate of 47%, there, that's where it's really clinically useful, especially, again, you're making a decision right now, today, for that patient who has not yet received treatment.
I'm curious, Susan, how you see patients, particularly, I'm sure you have patients in the medical field who really understand a lot of the subtlety, sort of sorting through this option. This happens all through solid tumor oncology, where you have the option where maybe the chance of response is pretty low, but if you do respond, you have the opportunity, maybe to go a long time, even talk maybe even the possibility of cure, better tolerated than chemotherapy. How do you see a patient sort of sorting through this, Susan, as they initially confront metastatic disease?
I would think that those who are savvy are really looking to say, if I don't have the marker, I don't even want to waste my time. And others who are, there's a lot of people, immunotherapy is in the news so much. Everybody thinks they carry their past knowledge of chemotherapy, of somebody, some other disease that they had a horrible experience with chemotherapy. And so then they say, well, I need immunotherapy. I need to get it. Can't you get it for me? Actually, there was a woman that presented our tumor board this week who had chemotherapy back in the 80s for her bladder cancer. And she said, such a horrible reaction. She was like, I will never, ever get chemo again. So I was like saying to this young doctor, I said, kind of keep in mind that, in the 80s, we couldn't take care of her very well with chemotherapy. So let's not like throw the baby out with the bathwater. I mean, they definitely can have responses. And, I still sometimes think it's better responses, and I wonder also, and I'm not sure of this data, but I did see information once that kind of said tumors that have a high mutational burden, not only they may respond well to immunotherapy, but they also respond well to cisplatin. So, it's still a good drug.
So just a couple other things, and then we want to start talking about some novel agents in bladder cancer. But we were talking before about earlier therapy. And Arjun, in lung cancer, first-line therapy, small cell, non-small cell, adenosquamous, chemo plus checkpoint inhibitor. other cancers are looking into it. Any comments on whether you think that's the future in bladder cancer?
Yeah, you pointed towards something that I think all of us in bladder cancer therapy were just extremely excited about. And for the last, you know, several years, we were convinced that, you know, whatever lesson we were going to learn in lung cancer, we were going to learn that lesson within a few years in bladder cancer. And so when we saw data from studies like KEYNOTE-189 with chemo plus pembrolizumab being with a hazard ratio of like something in the 0.6 range, we were expecting the same thing. And, you know, I'll be honest with you, I think, you know, Dr. O'Donnell probably shares his opinion as well, is that I was very underwhelmed with the data from INVIGOR 130, which we were hoping would show similar things. Again, this study, three-arm trial, the history of it is unique. It actually started off as a cis-ineligible study focusing on gemcarbo versus atezo, and then it expanded to the three-arm study that you see here. But the primary outcome that we were hoping to demonstrate was that atezo plus platinum and gem was definitively better than platinum gem alone. And so this debate of whether you should get chemo or IO, just, you know, put that to rest completely. Everyone gets both. You get the benefit of chemo, disease control, kind of the heavy hand of chemo, and you get immuno at the same time, and the durability, those complete remissions that we, you know, strive for, you'll get both of them at the same time, no more debate and no more controversy. But this study overwhelmed, and, you know, the PFS endpoint was met based on the statistical design, but the OS endpoint was still immature. You know, there was a trend toward an OS benefit, but I think many of us were just underwhelmed with this data. And then when we see the press release, you know, from KEYNOTE 361, which was just about a week ago, showing that it missed both on PFS and OS, it tells us that chemo plus IO is unfortunately not the answer in metastatic bladder cancer.
So there is some good news that came out recently, Peter, and I think this maybe is going to change practice. This is just from the ASCO meeting. We were talking Tuesday about the big ASCO paper on EGFR, TKI, osimertinib, and lung cancer. But this trial also was presented, I think, as a possibility to change practice, which is to use maintenance checkpoint inhibitor instead of combined with chemotherapy, to use it after, almost like we were talking about maintenance PARP inhibitors after chemo and ovarian cancer. Peter, can you run through what this saw and what you think about it? This is a big plenary presentation, one of the most important presentations in the whole ASCO meeting.
Right. This was very interesting data and probably is practice changing here, where the idea is that your patient goes through frontline platinum-based chemotherapy. And as we talked about traditionally then, you know, once they stop being able to tolerate platinum-based therapy, which usually, you know, you don't go beyond six cycles, then you would watch that patient. You would tell them, we're going to stop all therapy at this point and monitor your disease. We'll bring you in every 3 months for your CAT scan. And if that CAT scan ever shows that your disease is progressing, then we'll think about second line therapy with immunotherapy. So this trial tries to turn that concept a little bit upside down in that you wouldn't do that waiting. You would start the patient right on a maintenance approach with immunotherapy right after they complete the platinum-based frontline therapy. And it was a randomized trial. The immunotherapy agent that was looked at was avelumab, given every 2 weeks, compared to the best supportive care or observation alone. And the overall survival benefit was pretty dramatic here. You can see about a 7-month absolute extension on the overall survival, a very strong hazard ratio in this trial. And so pending approval of this type of strategy, I think it's very viable to consider this in your patients that are finishing platinum-based therapy.
And looks like the results were even better in the PD-L1 population. Peter, it makes a lot of sense. There's a 5 other and maybe even more checkpoint inhibitors that can start to be brought up into either the maintenance or upfront setting. Was this enough to convince you, Peter, to start doing this in your patients?
It is. I already have a patient asking me about when we can start. And so I plan to adopt it in my practice.
Interesting. So Anastasia, before we finish with checkpoint inhibitors, just touch lightly, because we get into this in so many different of our conferences, including our recent cancers. As we mentioned, there are 5 different checkpoint inhibitors are approved in bladder cancer, probably a lot more similar than dissimilar in terms of their benefits and risks. Whether you can tease out any difference, kind of hard to say, I think. But just kind of curious, in the bladder cancer situation, Anastasia, what kinds of toxicities, autoimmune toxicities, have you observed?
We have seen a lot of autoimmune toxicity, but the most common, I would say, is endocrine. We have a lot of patients who develop hypothyroidism, so thyroiditis. We do have a segment of our patients who develop colitis, hepatitis, pneumonitis. Those are common of the high-grade ones that we've seen. Of course, monitoring closely patients for symptoms, as well as doing workup earlier on and placing the appropriate referrals earlier on are very important. For example, to screen for endocrine toxicity, we check for TSH with every cycle. We check for cortisol, spot cortisol, and we do symptom assessment before each treatment.
Susan, any comments again on autoimmune toxicity? Any pearls, any suggestions?
You know, I kind of like put out to people an itis, any itis. You know, if you think you can get an inflammation of anything, you can get it. As I think about the people in my practice, you know, the renal overlaps with the bladder, and I'm trying to think if there's more, you know, certain AEs that happen in one disease versus the other, and I don't necessarily see that. I see a lot of rashes, varying degrees of rashes. And then it almost seems like, as Anastasia said, you know, you have to kind of be tuned into it. But all of a sudden, we'll get a run on hepatitis. And then another time, we're getting a run on colitis. And it makes no sense to me, but just always got to be alert for it.
You know, also, we've talked about the importance of educating people outside of oncology, hospitalists, ER people. We had a case in lung cancer. We talked about of a patient on a checkpoint inhibitor who went to a small hospital managed by a hospitalist with very severe diarrhea. They never thought about autoimmune and treated the antibiotics, antifungals. Patient comes back, the oncologist almost had a heart attack because she didn't even know the patient was in the hospital. So I think there's also the issue of letting our colleagues outside of oncology know about these phenomena.